Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name's Tom O'Farrell, and I represent the defendant below and the appellant, Mr. Scott Gramer. Your Honors, this case is a direct appeal from a criminal conviction after a guilty plea in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Indianapolis. In Indianapolis, Your Honor. Forgive me. Mr. Gramer pled guilty to 5 counts of mail fraud, and there was a sentencing hearing concerning what his sentence would be. Mr. Gramer at that time contested the amount of money that was the total lost and attributable to him, thereby affecting what his sentence would be under the guidelines 2F1.1. The law on this matter is fairly clear, and Mr. Gramer would certainly concede that when one is involved in a criminal activity, a scheme that involves many participants, the defendant is culpable for the entire amount of the loss. There's no disputing that. And the cases cited by the government are correct and on point in that. However, each one of those cases, Your Honors, also embraces language that culpability is not extended to situations where there are multiple schemes, where the defendant didn't have, in the cases used language like foreseeability, personal knowledge of what takes place outside of the scope of their own activity. In the present case, Mr. Gramer would direct the court's attention specifically to the amounts of loss that each participant in this scheme were alleged to have gained. We believe that the numbers that were put forth by the U.S. Probation Department support that, because the overall loss. No. What I'm suggesting is, if there is one actor that may be involved in a scheme, and yet there's another actor who let's say is the hub versus a spoke, who's the central character, the ringleader. Well, it would appear like that on first observation, but when you add up the numbers, they don't match. They don't add up. If we have a total loss of $430,000, and the hub in this case, Mr. Adair, receives $335,000. I appreciate that, Your Honor. And I understand some crooks are going to make more than others, just like lawyers. Okay, but in this case, if you look at the total loss, and everybody, and I'm going from what the court found, or what at least it relied upon its probation department for, nobody got more than 50%. And if you multiply out the total loss that could have been attributable here, it doesn't come up to $430,000. So my question, and the question that Mr. Gramer raises, is if this was one conspiracy, shouldn't these numbers add up to the total amount of loss of $430,000? And because it doesn't that point out to the fact... Right. Yes, sir. That's correct.
So what
I'm saying, Your Honor, is if you take the amount that, if everyone got a half, okay, and Mr. Adair was involved in every transaction, so we know he must have at least received a half at the most, a minimum 25%, then when you add up everybody but Adair, you should at least get close to the half of the 430,000. You don't, though. You get 162, as I recall. 165,756. Possibly. But we have to have a number to rely upon if we're going to sentence someone according to 2F1.1. I agree. We can see that. That's correct. That's correct.
So what if your man just was responsible for
400,000 rather than 430? Probably not much, Your Honor. I without looking at the guidelines in front of me, but my guess is it would only result in a one level reduction versus a multiple level reduction. But the concern, and this is the distinction I'm trying to make, is that if Adair was able to accumulate so much more money, there had to have been another scheme going on. Otherwise, the numbers don't add up. The $355,000 that you're suggesting that be added to Mr. Gramer's could not have been from the same scheme. It leads me to a couple different conclusions. One, the 430 reported by the victim is not correct. But I don't want to suggest that it was falsified in any way or that it was an intentional falsification. I'm just saying that perhaps that number is not right. The second possibility, of course, is that there was another scheme going on, that there was no foreseeability on the part of the other defendants and there was no knowledge of. Or the third possibility is all the numbers are wrong.
What kind of challenge was made at the
trial? We did challenge it. We did suggest to the court that culpability wasn't there, and the court rejected that assertion. We also, I would point out, specifically preserved this issue within our plea agreement because there had been this disagreement throughout the entire process of pleading guilty, the amount that Mr. Gramer was personally accountable for. Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you very much, Judge.
Thank you. May it please the Court. I am Sharon Jackson. I'm an Assistant United States Attorney representing the United States of America. And good morning. Still good morning. There was no clear error committed by the District Court in finding that there was a jointly undertaken criminal activity by all five defendants and that the defendant, Gramer, was at sentencing attributable not only to his personal gain but to the reasonably foreseeable gain of the others. As this court has recognized in the Townsend case, joint actions are inherently more dangerous than individual criminal acts, and therefore they can be punished more harshly. Two cases among many from this court have previously rejected the same argument that has been put forth by Defendant Gramer here today, both in the Dillard case and the Narvaez case. Those were instances in which the defendants asked to be held accountable only for their own personal gain in that, and this court rejected that argument in both of those cases. The numbers actually do add up, Your Honor, and I would refer the court to the defendant's appendix at page 32, where there is a chart that was submitted by the United States at sentencing that deals with the whole $430,000 and how, with the checks payable to the five different entities, who got what percentage of each of that. What Defendant Gramer fails to grasp in this is that the percentage that they got ranged from 25% to 50%. He focuses on the 50%. If Mr. Gramer only received on average 25% of the proceeds, he was at least involved in $204,000 worth of invoices. However, what is critical to the analysis here is the fact that Mr. Gramer was personally aware that his signature would not be on all of the purchase orders or invoices approving payment in this scheme to defraud his employer. That was critical to the success of this scheme because neither Mr. Adair and Mr. Gramer didn't want one person's signature appearing on all the paperwork, fearing that that would draw attention to it. So Mr. Gramer was personally aware that his signature would not be on all of the documents. And so not only was it reasonably foreseeable, the success of the scheme depended on the fact that others would be signing off on the paperwork so not to have to call attention. So it was appropriate for the district court, in fact, correct for the district court, to attribute the entire loss to him. When Mr. Gramer talks about a hub and spokes, Mr. Gramer was at the hub with Mr. Adair because he was the insider approving off on the paperwork. He dealt with all of the five fictitious vendors. He profited personally from every single one of the five fictitious vendors. Granted, he did not profit as much as Mr. Adair did, but he profited substantially more than the other three co-defendants. Yes, Your Honor, and if you look at the chart on the appendix, page 32, it shows that Mr. Reed only received less than $1,400, and Mr. Richardson received about $6,500, and Mr. Cook almost $23,000. So their cumulative totals were less than
$30,000.
They all pled guilty. The loss attributed to them was the total amount of invoices that they were personally involved in, not just their personal gain. Because Mr. Gramer was involved with all five of the fictitious companies, whereas Mr. Reed, Mr. Richardson, and Mr. Cook were only involved with the invoices that pertain to them.
They were unaware of the rest of the scheme?
Mr. Reed had some knowledge as to one of Mr. Richardson, but was unaware of Mr. Cook. And if those amounts had been in, given the guidelines at the time, there would have been no difference because I believe the first cutoff was either $10,000 or $20,000. So it would not have made any difference in the computation of Mr. Reed's calculation in this case. Mr. Gramer was at the central part of this, and it was appropriate for the court to tag him with all of the loss. If there are no further questions, I would waive the remainder of my time and rely on the briefs submitted and ask the court to affirm the district court. Thank you.
I won't pretend that I did well in math, Your Honor. But I would point out an error in the government's calculation. Ms. Jackson suggests that Mr. Adair could have participated in this more than 50%, but the finding of the court is 50%. So that nobody received more than 50%. There's a line between 25 and 50%. If Mr. Adair participated in every transaction and the most he could have received was 50%, the other 50% has to be attributed to one, two, three of the co-defendants. When you put that limitation that no one received more than 50% into the calculation, there's no way that Mr. Adair could have received 75% and Mr. Gramer received 25%. Just following the findings of the court, Your Honor. I'm saying what you should do is you should double what the co-defendants received as the other part of the equation. Mr. Dare is the constant. He received at minimum 25%, but at most 50%. But he's in every transaction according to the pre-sentence investigation. If you take the other fellows, add them together, you only come up with $165,000 that they were involved in total. So, thank you very much for the opportunity. If there's no further questions, I'll finish. Thank you.